When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Rees.
Hello, folks.
How you been, Brian?
I've been fantastic.
Okay. Today on the program, we'll be talking about a grim and gritty take on Green Arrow long before the CW was ever even a concept, let alone the...
Gritty Green Arrow. Very well done.
Yes. I can alliterize with the best of them. Yes, it's Mike Grell's 1987 miniseries, The Longbow Hunters. But before we get into that, we want to talk about something going on in the world of comics that is not related to people being awful and hateful. In fact, it's just the opposite. We're going to talk about love.
We're exactly the same.
Yeah, we're going to talk about love in the comics. It's all fun. Because it has been announced that The Thing, Ben Grimm, will finally marry Alicia Masters. Because that has been some blind devotion.
Oh, man.
So we thought we'd talk about...
See that coming, Paul.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so we thought we'd talk about some of the more famous marriages in the world of comics. Do you have
First of all, let's make sure we're certain, you know, they're saying they're going to get married.
Oh, no, of course they're going to... If they say they're going to get married, they're going to get married.
Oh, right, yes.
No one would ever pull the rug out from under you at all.
That would never happen. Not in the history of comics has that ever been done.
Well, not recently, for sure.
Or certainly not in the last couple months.
That really hurt you. I'm sorry.
Sads. So many sads.
I kind of knew it was going to happen. We are, of course, talking about Batman.
It was pretty much telegraphed. I mean, there were all kinds of clues.
Well, in the history of Batman comics, he has almost been married multiple times.
True, true. Yeah.
He almost married Lois Lane at one point.
Yes. Yes, he did.
Yeah, but usually it's, you know, he's getting married. No, it was just a dream.
Right. Yeah. Or a wacky plot device.
Or a wacky plot device. Ra's al Ghul trying to trick him into, you know, stealing his money or something. I don't know.
Or, you know, Mr. Mixel Plixen Plixen Plaxen Plooxen.
You can say that again. Backwards, preferably.
Well, sure. That'll make the whole thing go away.
Well, keeping on the thing, Alicia Masters thing. We have to mention that time.
Speaking of thing, how does things thing work?
I don't know. It's a rocky road they have to overcome.
See, no one talks about that.
For good reason, Brian.
I kind of worry about the poor girl.
Jeez.
This is going to get cut, isn't it?
I hope so. So moving right along, there was that time that the Human Torch, Johnny Storm, married Alicia Masters. Do you remember that at all?
No.
It happened, I want to say it was in the 80s, probably, or early 90s. It was right after Secret War, so it would be late 80s. And it was a terrible thing to have happen. Ben Grimm had the sads, of course.
As he would.
But it turned out it wasn't really Alicia. It was a Skrull.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah. Which, you know, which made everything fine. However, Johnny still did marry. He did think it was Alicia.
Right.
So, which still makes him kind of a jerk.
Well, he is kind of a jerk, right? I mean, that's kind of his character.
Yeah, I mean, that is true.
One could argue that was maybe a step beyond. You like, think? In the world of jerk.
Yeah, that's going a little above and beyond jerkiness.
Yeah. Yeah, but his just rewards for that was that he slept with a Skrull, so he's going to have to live with that for the rest of his life.
Is that such a bad thing?
They've retconned that. Has that been retconned?
I'm sure it has, somewhere along the line. All of this, by the way, everything we're going to talk about has been retconned at some point, or will be retconned at some point. Well, keeping on the Fantastic Four...
Or retconned multiple times.
Yes. Keeping on the Fantastic Four bandwagon... There is, of course, the marriage of Sue Storm and Reed Richards, which was back in the 60s. That was one of the big...
And it's been dysfunctional ever since.
Well, yes. Reed's kind of a dysfunctional guy.
Yeah.
To say he's a good husband is a stretch.
No.
but if you've ever read that, it was
going to continue because
it's definitely going to continue.
Probably give a warning to the listeners.
If there's any regular listeners, you know this is going to happen. but the marriage of Sue and Reed. First of all, it happened in an annual, back when annuals meant something.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, and it was a big darn deal because everybody in the Marvel universe showed up.
Right.
Including Stan and Jack Kirby, who were not allowed to come to the wedding. That's a thing that happens in there. They show up and they're kicked and they're blocked from coming to the wedding and they're made to go home, which is great.
Did they not bring their invite?
I'll be honest. I forget the exact reason why they were kicked out. But if anyone can get Fantastic Four Annual 3, if anyone pick that up, read it. It's just so much fun. It's just crazy, weird battles with every single person in the Marvel Universe at the time. And Daredevil drives a car, which is neat. But of course, they do get married, and they have a child who still hasn't grown up yet.
No, that's
very odd.
Well, aging in comics is a whole other topic.
Yes. So do you have any marriages that you want to bring up?
I don't know. I mean, it's just it's interesting, like how comics deal with marriages. I mean, you have Reed and Sue, you have Peter Parker and Mary Jane.
No, to my knowledge, that never actually happened.
Is that right?
Yes. I mean, people say they got married, but there was a brand new day. Nothing happened.
We got Lois Lane and Clark Kent.
Yes.
We have.
They are still technically married, even though
yes,
Bendis has split them up somehow.
Well, but you know, it's like they were married and then they weren't married.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're married again. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I'm sure they were married and unmarried multiple times.
Yeah,
and then of course in the movies they were kind of married, and then there was the super kiss that made Lois forget everything.
It's a hell of a kiss.
It is a hell of a kiss. He's got some seriously weird powers in the movies.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, no. They're just never going to get the movies right.
That's not true. I hope they get the movies right.
Someday. I mean, they might get some of the movies right, but they're never going to get Superman right.
Well, and you know, there's tons of people listening to this who are yelling at their phone or whatever they're listening to this on. Christopher Reeve is great. We love him, but those movies are a little campy.
Oh yeah, I mean Christopher Reeve is the iconic Superman in pretty much anybody of a certain age's eyes. And you know, he looked the part.
Well, he was very good. I mean, he's very good at playing that role. But I don't know. I'd like to see a serious take that doesn't take itself so seriously. If that makes any sense at all.
No, that does make sense.
Okay, because the Zack Snyder stuff does take itself seriously. Oh my God, does it take itself seriously?
Well, and then there's the Snyder Cut, but
oh yeah,
which we're all still waiting for with bated breath.
I want someone to remake a combination Superman Last Jedi, you know, Superman v Superman v Last Jedi, and you know, so every disgruntled fanboy out there can have their perfect movie.
Well, they all have their perfect movie in their minds.
Anyway. Yeah, but we're talking about marriage,
right? Marriage. so, who are what we got? We got Jessica Jones and
Luke Cage. Yeah,
that's a decent one, right?
That was a decent one. They had their issues,
right?
There is, of course, probably
Black Bolt and Medusa.
Black Bolt and Medusa. Yes, they're still going strong.
Are they? I'm not. I don't want to give a spoiler here, but aren't most of the Inhumans dead now? I can't keep up with that. I'm not following that. I know they killed the dog. The spoiler alert.
They'll all come back. Yeah. You know what? I guess we're just straying from the topic back and forth. But that series, Death of the Inhumans, they're not straying away from the death part of it. I mean, pretty much everyone's gonna die.
Well, it is in the title.
Wow.
So
that doesn't But you usually, when you say death of the Inhumans, it's death of the Inhumans you don't know. We're going to keep the ones you do. It's very rare that the big names go out, but holy cow.
And if they do, you know they're coming back at some point.
Yeah, but in general, Black Bolt and Medusa have been going strong. I mean, if there's any problems in that marriage, Black Bolt isn't talking about it.
He's keeping it to himself.
But
who are some of the, we're probably missing some like major.
Well, in keeping with today's topic, Green Arrow and Black Canary.
Did they ever get married?
I believe they got married.
I remember a few years ago, there was a wedding special. Yeah, it was. They got married. I have that. And I think I read it once and was so impressed with it that I never read it again. I can't remember if they actually got married or not.
I think they did, in fact, get married. But, was it rebooted with New 52? You know what? Here's a tip to all up-and-coming podcasters out there. Do research before you start talking. But there is, of course, the very famous and controversial marriage between North Star and Kyle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was a pretty big deal at the time.
For its time.
Well, speaking of Inhumans, there was also the marriage between Quicksilver and Crystal, which didn't last that long.
You had to tell me about this one, and I didn't.
This was back in the 70s when they were just trying different things. I think the idea was to have Crystal, who was pretty much associated with the Fantastic Four at that point,
right?
Even though she was with the Inhumans, and then they were trying to move her into the X-Men briefly. But, as with all things Quicksilver does, it went pretty quickly. but they did have a kid. They had Luna.
Right.
I don't know. Is Luna even
still? Oh, yeah, I remember Luna. And we haven't even talked about Barry Allen and Iris West.
Oh, that's right.
And Sue and Ralph Dibny.
They got married.
Yeah. Hence the Sue and Ralph Dibny part.
I thought it was Sue and Ralph Dibny or Dibny.
that's one of the nicest marriages, right? I mean, Sue and Ralph, and of course, then it just got destroyed.
Yeah, that's why we can't have nice things.
Right. With that stupid identity crisis. Although the attempt to revive them as ghost detectives in the 52 the weekly comic that DC did was actually kind of a wonderful idea that someone should have picked up on and carried on. I mean, I would read a comic book that featured Sue and Ralph Dibny as ghost detectives.
Sue and Ralph Dibny
as ghost detectives. Would you not read that, Paul?
Absolutely. Of course. Now, would they be detectives hunting ghosts, or would they be ghosts who are detectives?
Are there ghosts who are detectives? Because they were dead, remember?
Yeah.
Well, they could hunt, but they could be ghost detectives hunting ghosts, or they could be ghost detectives hunting not ghosts.
Not ghosts, otherwise known as the living.
Well, not all non-living are ghosts.
That is some deep stuff right there, Brian. Well, basically,
I'm not married to the idea, but
I guess what this whole ridiculous conversation is bringing up is the fact that these marriages in comics are usually done as, spectacle.
Gimmicks
that get you to buy a bunch of comics and are almost always immediately retconned.
Right.
And removed, which is why this latest Batman thing bugs you more than it bugs me, but I would have really liked to have seen Batman and Catwoman, Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle, be a married crime-fighting duo.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually an interesting concept. Right. And it's interesting when, you have like Clark Kent and Lois Lane I don't even know, we're focused on marriage, which I get because it's still like a social construct that many people care about and what have you, but it doesn't, I don't even know if it, it's not even getting stuck on marriage. It's like, we could just call a stable relationship, an extended, long, stable relationship that's more than just, dating. you know, a lifetime partnership or what have you. It's so, but yeah, it's, you can't have that in comics because once things are too good for a character, then the writers or the editors have to go in and mess it up for, you know, plot device.
Well, the easy way to create conflict is to have, you know, a breakup or people arguing.
Right.
Or something like that. You know, the more difficult way to create, you know, a relationship is to have something nuanced and complicated.
Right.
Still a loving couple. Are there any examples of that? I mean, right now there's Gambit and Kitty Pryde.
Right.
Mr. and Mrs. X, which is a ridiculous name.
Which came out of misdirection as well.
Yes. Yeah. That, yeah.
Wait, it's no, not Gambit and Kitty Pryde. It's Gambit and Rogue.
Gambit and Rogue. You are correct.
Yeah, right. Edit that. You want to edit that, Paul. Trust me.
Nah. I can make mistakes. It's fine.
Gambit and Rogue. Well, you got half of it for the first, for the promised wedding and half of it for the actual wedding.
You know, that's actually not a bad premise. I will admit I have not read that comic, so I can't talk about it intelligently.
Yeah.
But the concept is actually quite interesting because Rogue and Gambit are an interesting dynamic couple to have together, and they both talk ridiculous.
They both talk ridiculous?
That's right. They both have ridiculous accents.
This is true. Only they can understand each other.
Which makes it difficult for the reader.
Oh yeah, let's not even get into accents in comics and how those are represented.
Ugh. Well, I guess the whole point of this is, as long as people are going to get sucked in by the spectacle of it, I think there's always going to be marriages. Well, just even on TV, there was a marriage on Flash.
Right. That would be Barry and Iris West. Barry Allen and Iris West. That would, more interesting would be if Barry took Iris's last name. Where were we headed in all this?
I don't know. I don't think we have a direction. I think we're just going to slowly peter out, and then we.
I think we just wanted to list marriages we could think of in comics.
That's pretty much it.
And that even failed because you know that we probably missed about 50.
Oh yeah, we missed tons, I'm sure. Again, kids out there, do your research before you start the podcast. Yes. Don't just come up with a concept seconds before you start the recording. On that note, let's take a break. Let's plug a different podcast who are good and prepared. And when we come back, we'll talk about the Longbow Hunters.
Sounds good.
Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
I'm Zatanna. Why do you care about some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Black Canary and Zatanna, together in one podcast. I'm Ryan Daly, and I've got a thing for superheroes in fishnet stockings. That's why I started Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. Join me every 2 weeks as I celebrate the blonde bombshell and the mistress of magic in their exciting adventures published by DC Comics. Power of Fishnets. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
And we're back. Paul, what do you have for us today?
Originally a Robin Hood pastiche full of gimmicks, trick arrows, and the occasional team-up with other green-hued heroes, Green Arrow was a decidedly minor player in the DC pantheon, reserved for the kind of stories that tend to get dismissed as silly or fluff. Even with the occasional foray into the very special issue, let's face it, they still came off pretty hokey. That is until Mike Grell got a hold of the character in 1987. The Longbow Hunters, written and drawn by Grell, ages up Oliver Queen to middle age and infuses the character with his military experience and that of a hunter into Green Arrow's persona and skill set. In doing so, Grell gave the series a more mature and gritty feel. In fact, it could be argued, and spoilers, I will argue, that this was the first real grimdark take on a character in continuity to go mainstream, as well as an early example of the darker tone in comics that would come to dominate the late 80s and 90s, both in style and in substance. The story begins with Oliver Queen turning 40 and feeling that he's missed out on the good things in life, like family. He moves to Seattle with former Black Canary and current girlfriend Dinah Lance. Once there, he begins to use his skills as a hunter to track down a serial killer. And along the way, he becomes embroiled with gangsters, corrupt politicians, low-life drug dealers, the Japanese Yakuza, and a young female archer that may not only be his match, but may be his better. Burrell takes Green Arrow to street-level perspective. He adds harsh, sometimes brutal violence to the story that's not only visceral, but has real consequences. Highly influential, the Longbow Hunters started a trend in comic book storytelling that, for good or ill, is still with us to this day. Brian, what'd you think of the Longbow Hunters?
Well, I thought it was, it's interesting because, man, I had not read this in quite some time. Mm-hmm. And I remember being a younger lad and it coming out. And I remember being at the funny bookstore and, you know, that's what everybody was talking about was, you know, holy crow, what's going on here? You know, and it was all the rage, you know, and I don't, who knows what the sales were like, but I remember at least at my local comic shop as a kid that it was a pretty big deal, and it was something that the comic shop was definitely pushing and people were talking about when I was in there. And of course, I was too young to understand everything that they were talking about. And technically, I probably was not allowed to buy the comic, but I did because they didn't care.
Yeah, there wasn't the same kind of strict regulation on this sort of thing back then.
Right. I think you know, parents were not, parents were still like, oh, it's comic books. So
exactly.
They weren't, you know, necessarily regulating what comics their kids were reading at the time. They still don't, but, you know, you do have like a certain set of concerned parents who are excessively involved in their child's every waking moment. But
I wasn't like that at all. Don't worry about it.
but yeah, so it was kind of a little bit of a weird thrill, you know, to pick it up and, you know, get it home. And even then I think I was reading it, in secret. And
really? Okay.
Well, you know, I had religious parents, so even though they weren't monitoring my comic book reading, I wasn't going to sit out in the living room with a comic book that had half naked people in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of Oliver Queen butt.
Yes. Yeah. And so my memory of it, I think, and I'd read it again, maybe 10 years ago, probably when at some point when a trade had come out, I picked it up again or got it at the library or got it at the Tattered Cover bookstore, plug. And
that's in Denver, everybody.
Yes. But, I think 10 years ago or so when I read it last, I still found it pretty interesting. Reading it again, it's still a fascinating comic. There's parts of me that, and we could get into this, that I'm wondering how well it holds up now. Mm-hmm. There's some plotting issues that I have a problem with, which maybe at the end of the day are pretty minor. But for the most part, again, it's easy to see why it was so important at the time. It's also easy to see why, in retrospect, with all that we have now, it comes across, I don't want to say quaint, because I think we use quaint for the last podcast for the Uncle Scrooge, of which this is not the same type of quaint.
We also used adorable, which this is not.
This is not adorable. Okay, so some of it came across as a little quaint, but I don't know. It's still, I think, an important read and an important signpost from its time. I don't know. Does that? Am I?
No. I think you're spot on. I mean, I remember reading this as well. I was a senior in high school when this came out.
Yeah, you had a couple years on me and non-religious parents or non.
Oh no!
Evangelical parents.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, so I do remember this, and it was shocking, absolutely shocking when this came out. And
right, yes.
Yeah, and it was, I wasn't hiding it from anyone or anything like that, but at the same time, if it felt a little wrong to be reading it, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And yeah, and you're right. It doesn't quite hold up today as it did back then, but it was very important then. And we can get into some of the details because
sure.
There are some problematic things about it that you can look back on and say, well, that's not great. And again, right. We'll get into the details later, but it was very important. Like what I was trying to say in the synopsis was before this, there was, you know, things like The Dark Knight had come out the year before.
Right.
And other things like Alan Moore's Swamp Thing had happened. But that real kind of dark, gritty feeling, that dark, gritty storytelling hadn't quite entered into the mainstream, into your comic book superheroes.
Right. You could argue Batman, but Batman always had a dark side. And
yeah, but see and even things like...
even though you had your goofy runs on Batman throughout his career, you also had writers like Denny O'Neill and such who had taken him to a darker place that Green Arrow and other mainstream characters had not gone.
Yeah, exactly. But not this dark. I mean, yes, you could say Frank Miller did that, but that was sort of an alternate universe that wasn't
right.
That wasn't in main continuity. You know,
right.
Dark Knight's something else.
Or was it marketed as such? Yeah,
exactly. Because this, you know, Grell would go on to write an ongoing Green Arrow for what, 10, 11 years after this?
Yeah, forever.
Yeah, and taking this type of storytelling.
Yeah. And now he toned it down. Some of it got toned down a little bit going forward when it moved out of sort of the prestige format that it was in for Longbow Hunters.
Yeah, well, they wanted to make it more accessible to the younger reader.
Right.
Yeah. But at the same time, it was still fairly dark and gritty. But it was, I think the fact that he showed that this could be profitable and could be popular and critics loved this at the time, you know, that really ushered in what we find in the 90s, you know, that dark and gritty storytelling.
In some ways, some folks may think I'm a bit nuts here. It feels, some of the feel of the story, you had mentioned street level. And I in your intro, and I agree with that because it felt street level in a Marvel Comics kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you caught. I don't know if that it was an impression you took away at all, but it's an impression I got. It didn't. You know, it's not a Marvel character, and it's not done in a Marvel style necessarily, like with the writing. But there is a feel to how things play out, and it's one of the I kept having Elektra flashbacks.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And also like even some Wolverine flashbacks in the Wolverine Elektra stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Even it's very similar to the Wolverine miniseries drawn by Frank Miller. Yeah, Frank Miller. Yeah. So I mean, but just the fact that Green Arrow is taken out of Star City, you know, the DC universe is usually in their own made-up cities, whereas
right.
Marvel's usually in a real concrete place. Taking him out of Star City and putting him in Seattle, a real, you know, a real world city, that felt very Marvel-y.
Yes. Yeah. And DC does acknowledge the existence of New York and Chicago. It seems as if nothing actually ever happens in those cities in the DC universe.
Yes. Yeah, real-world cities are kind of boring. In
right.
comparison. But the way... you know, there's a very, especially the street scenes, there's a very, you know, Taxi Driver, Martin Scorsese kind of feel.
Right.
To these things. Overall, the way it's drawn is very cinematic, or at least the way it's paced in the way that the pages are laid out. And I don't know if that was a conscious choice to make it like those, like that 1970s gritty feel. But it's definitely there.
But it's also it is also reflecting Seattle at the time.
True,
because we weren't that many years away from a little three-piece band that burst out of Seattle that also had some drug problems and you know what have you. And so we're not that far away from Nirvana and the spotlight, right? And the spotlight on Seattle.
I was going to say, was it Hanson?
It was Hanson.
Yeah, well, Seattle was...
You know, and then a spotlight was kind of turned on that city in some ways, whether accurately or not. And, you know, Seattleites might have... Are they Seattleites? from the city of
they Seattle. They go around and around. Seattleites.
It's in that big thing on the anyway. I'm sure they have their own take on how their city has been represented fictionally and, you know, in news reports and documentaries and whatnot, mm-hmm. and their experiences may differ. But you see the seeds of what people came to think that Seattle was like in this comic, like years before that spotlight, again, like I said, was turned on the city in a much harsher light.
Yeah, well, let's get into some of the specifics.
Sure.
For instance, you had mentioned something about plotting was a little bit.
I had difficulty following the plot at various points.
I did have to go back a couple of times as well. I knew the story.
Right.
But when I'm trying to do a close reading and I thought, well, that doesn't exactly flow. Like the whole fact that in the beginning it's chasing a serial killer.
Right.
And that serial killer does tangentially tie into the main big bad of the story.
Sort of, but so clarify for me, because I've read this several times over the past couple weeks, and the serial killer, so for folks who ever read this or are curious what we're talking about, there's sort of two, there's a Robin Hood killer who is killing a bunch of old men, and then there's a serial, which is a running bit in the book. But then there's also another serial killer who is killing prostitutes, basically.
Yes. And he was so that the prostitute killer is one who used to be in an army regiment. We will find out later, did something terrible. This one guy was, you know, a bit crazy.
Right.
Obviously, he became a serial killer.
But
through him being caught, or captured, or killed, I should say.
Killed. By the Robin Hood killer.
By the Robin Hood killer. Oliver Queen then, with his detective work, finds out that he is connected to these other military guys.
Well, wait, this is where I get confused. So talk me through this. Is he?
He was connected to them.
Right, because here's where I'm confused. Because he's a good 30, 40 years younger than these guys. So there's that, and...
You're right, he's from Vietnam, where the other guys are from World War II.
Right, and so the killer that... This is going to get a little complex. So we have there is a group of old vets who were up to no good during World War II with a plot to steal money from the Yakuza via a Japanese gentleman who was kept in a camp. In an internment camp here in the U.S. So you have that group of people who are the group that the Robin Hood killer is going after. And then you have this serial killer who is damaged and has issues clearly with women. And this is an issue that we could discuss, talk about in a little bit, who is killing, I believe it's just prostitutes, streetwalkers, what have you. But it took me two reads to figure out that I don't believe he was connected with the other group. The other group had their own psycho who we see later on in the comic and interacting with Dinah Lance. But the serial killer, I think it was happenstance that the Robin Hood killer killed the serial killer.
Yeah, as well as one of the other guys passing.
Time that he was taking out one of the group of the World War II veterans. Right. Now, it took me two or three reads.
But they were both wearing that together. Yeah, well, they were all the World War II guy who was killed in a car. I just happened to be passing the serial killer.
Well, they were both tracking him. Yeah.
Well, they were both wearing dog tags, which is why they started. Which is why Oliver started going down the route of trying to find people with a military background.
But from different wars.
I was under the impression that they had not served together, but they were employing the serial killer. Is that not true?
Maybe that's it. But in the flashback scenes where the serial killer was represented, it was the representation of the soldiers who were caretaking him appeared to be of the same age as him.
I will admit the first book, because it's three books, and the first book is a bit confused, as you can say, you know.
This is the point I'm trying to get to, is not to try to actually figure it out, is to say that I think it's not very clear.
Yeah, once the serial killer is out of the way, the tunnel rat is out of the way, and they can focus only on the World War II people and the Yakuza, that's when the story sort of coalesces and becomes pretty straightforward.
Right.
And you can follow what's going on. But yes, I do agree that in the beginning, it's a little bit all over the place, because Oliver's chasing the serial killer, the Robin Hood killer, which is Shadow.
He's an assassin from the Yakuza.
Yeah. You know, there's that storyline, and then there's Dinah going off and doing her own investigations. So yes, it's a little convoluted in the beginning. I will admit that. It's a little bit confusing, but it sort of evens its way out once a few players have been taken off the board, which we should get, you know, should be told that people die in this. And that's something that wasn't happening in mainstream DC comics at this point, you know. And
I mean, people would die, but it was like, you know, the Joker would kill 500 people, but you know, there are 500 people the Joker killed. Somebody cares.
Yeah. Well, this was, well, no, but the hero wasn't doing it. And this is this the first time that Oliver Queen actually kills someone?
I believe, yes. So,
you know, I don't want to say definitively, maybe something happened in the 60s.
I think it is strongly, because I do not have a strong Green Arrow, you know, historical knowledge. I have to admit that right off the bat. There is a reference that he makes to killing once, but I believe that the reference was to an animal, because then he said that's why he stopped hunting. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, Paul. I mean, this is one of the biggest deals in this comic, and probably one of the biggest topics is that Oliver Queen kills.
Yes, deliberately, and yeah, I mean, he does have some remorse afterwards, but he doesn't hesitate. He kills in this. Now, the reason he kills is because Dinah Lance is being tortured.
Right.
Which, this is one of the things that this is the specific thing I was talking about. This is a problematic part of the story.
Yes, and it is for me as well, because, you go ahead and present
Well, first of all,
we'll probably both agree on this.
Does this fall into the category of fridging?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay. That's definitive, because I think so as well. It's gratuitous, far beyond what was necessary for the story, I think. I understand that this was a time when they were trying to push the boundaries and to try to make things as visceral as possible. But it doesn't read well.
No, and it also doesn't represent well. So to paint the picture is Dinah Lance is, it's your typical, it's not just Freddy, it's women in bondage.
Yeah.
And it's a semi-naked woman strung up, tied up and strung up and being tortured.
Yeah. While the men who are doing the torturing are casually saying things like, do you want a piece of this before I ruin it? Or things like that. And
right.
That's just, yeah. That took me aback. I had forgotten how far this went.
And we're not saying that representation of terrible things is wrong, and I'm not saying that there are not a time and place to represent that. You know, we're not censors.
No, I'm not being a prude by any stretch of the imagination. Right. But at the same time,
it did not. One could argue that it fed the story, because that led to Oliver Queen making what we believe is his first kill. He was so enraged by it that's when he made his first kill.
Yes. But the beating and butchering of a woman in order to have the male protagonist reach his potential.
Moment.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not something that is, it's something that's been done thousands of times in history, but it's not something that is it's not a good thing.
No,
there are ways to get that moment without resorting to this. It's cheap and easy, basically.
Yeah. It's lazy at the least, and it borders on.
Yeah.
I'm not going to
struggling for words.
I know the word I want to use, but I'm not going to use it. But it's lazy at the least, and at its worst, it's something well worse. And I'll leave it at that. So
plus the fact that this is Black Canary, who has been rendered powerless,
right,
and loses all. This is supposed to be a very capable woman, capable person, who has just been rendered
even more so. She's a powerful super. Well, powerful. She's a superhero who could pretty much kick any normal human being's ass.
Right. Well, she's been depowered and made to be a punching bag.
Right.
Which makes it even worse. So that happened.
But conversely, then Grell builds up the assassin, the Yakuza assassin, mm-hmm. the female, as someone who is more powerful than Oliver Queen.
Yeah, who kicks his ass. That's Shadow is her name.
Yeah, Shadow. And so he's creating an interesting contrast. I don't know if he did that on purpose or not, but if he did, and he is using the weakness of one woman to build up the strength of another woman, again, and if he's doing that on purpose, that's a problem as well.
Yeah, and, you know, it doesn't feel like that was intentional,
right,
as you read it. That doesn't come across in the text, but Shadow is still a pretty great character. She's ruthless and strong and powerful and gets the better of Oliver Queen over and over and over again.
She's a better archer than he is.
He's a better archer. She kicks his ass. They attack each other hand to hand and she kicks his ass, which he has to lay there going, God, I'm old.
which leads to the non-gratuitous, Oliver Queen in the shower butt scene.
Yeah. Well, there's in the shower, he's in the bath. Grell liked drawing Oliver naked, I think. Which, you know, read whatever you want into that.
There's also throughout the story all these reactions to Oliver Queen's supposed great attractiveness, too.
Well, I think that's actually, it is addressed once in the story, but I think it's hilarious. He has a pretty distinctive mustache and beard action going on. So if he's not wearing his little domino mask, people would still go, yeah, I know who you are, man.
Which has always been the case. It's even worse than the, it's even worse than the Superman glasses thing.
Yeah.
Because at least with Clark Kent, Superman, he is kind of a generic looking person. You know, he's just, there's no distinctive facial features on Superman, and it's part of why they've been able to get away with nudge, nudge, wink, wink about the, oh, well, he's wearing glasses, so no one can recognize him. But yeah, with Oliver Queen, it's the stinking mustache and beard.
Yeah, he's got a blonde, pointy beard.
Maybe he's running for mayor.
Maybe today, with all the hipsters, he could get lost in a crowd. But back then, that was pretty distinctive. So what do you think of the final showdown? If you want to skip ahead a little bit to there. First of all, it's on they go to Mount Rainier, which is really, I found this very fascinating myself, to take it out of the city and then put it back into nature again, you know? So
which mirrors his origin a little bit. Well, he says, I think at one point when he goes into the mountains and he looks around and he says home.
Yes.
And he's also in Sherwood Forest, right? I mean,
side note, it's not in this series, it's in a previous series where Black Canary, Dinah Lance, retires and opens up a flower shop called Sherwood Florist.
It's in the series too.
Right,
because that's where they're setting up. It's Sherwood Florist.
You do see
the sign at least once, if not a couple times in this particular arc.
Yeah.
You do see the Sherwood Florist.
Which is great.
which again is just, having Oliver Queen work in Sherwood Florist.
As one who loves a good pun, that's fantastic.
Yes.
But the showdown in the mountains, in the snow, it's actually really tense.
And it's extremely tense.
Yeah.
And I think it's where Mike Grell shines as an artist. The rest of the comic looks good. We should mention that the comic looks good.
Yeah.
It's a little bit dated in its style.
I want to address that.
Okay.
A little bit later, in detail, because we'll address that in detail later. Yes, but I don't know if you know Grell's work. What's the other comic he did? Warlord.
Oh, right.
So Grell's work on Warlord, which has a lot of nature scenes and a lot of big burly men in nature. It's true. And it really looks good.
Yeah.
So when they get to this point, he's starting, it feels natural, mm-hmm. you know, not just the setting, but he seems comfortable in this setting. And all of that confusion that we were talking about before goes away because everything starts making sense. He lays out where all the protagonists are. He lays out what the
consequences
are. Yeah.
And we kind of get what is actually going on and, you know, and who actually represents what. And, you know, the Iran-Contra, you know, faction and the drug dealing faction and all of that sort of stuff. It does start to gel, yeah.
Yeah. So the Iran-Contra thing did seem out of left field. As if
it
fits, but it just like it was just sort of thrown in all of a sudden. It's like, oh, were you watching the news when you were writing this? That's what it was starting. But it's really, like I said, it's really tense, but it why this hasn't been recreated on television or in the movies is beyond me, because it's really a great scene where you don't know who, you know, because Shadow and Oliver are they're at each other, but they're also going after these other people. Then there's a sniper in the tree, and they're helping each other out while still trying to get the bad guys. And then the bad guys essentially get away with it, at least for a little while. Except for a helicopter crash and many people dying.
Right. And the creepy government agent basically gets away with it completely.
And gives Oliver all the money, which he keeps.
Which he keeps, yes.
I found that very odd.
Well, what does Robin Hood do, Paul?
He gives to the poor, I don't believe Oliver Queen is... Rich. And gives to the rich? Because Oliver's rich.
Well, we don't know what he's going to do with that money.
He says at the end, I just got a raise. I think he's going to keep it.
it's most likely blood money.
Oh, my God, yes.
I don't know, Paul.
It's drug money? It's blood money?
If you were a superhero vigilante and someone handed you $300,000, what would you do with it?
Well, me, obviously, I would give it to charity because I'm just that kind of a guy.
Right. How would you give it to charity, though? You can't put it in the bank, right?
In a canvas bag.
In a canvas bag. So then the charity has to figure out what to do. Yes, and sacks with dollar signs on it.
Yeah,
it is weird though. Yes, it's absolutely a strange. It's one of the in a comic that has a lot of strange moments. It's certainly one of the stranger ones in which he just is like, "Oh, all right, great, $300." The guy just gave him $300,000 and he keeps it.
Yeah, and there was the last scene where. The big bad guy decides to, you know, wrap everything up in a neat little bow by monologuing about his plan. It's
very important to have the bad guy monologue.
Which, you know, completely out of nowhere. He just comes in and just starts telling him, you know, and then says, you're probably wondering why I'm telling you all this. Yeah. that seemed a little bit out of place, but that was something that needed to be told, obviously, so that we could understand the story and the motivations behind the characters. But I found that very jarring because Shadow's backstory was thrown in little pieces here and there throughout.
In actually a very interesting way, like in these sidebars.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And that's something that brings me to get into the art. The way that this, cause I'm reading this digitally. I have the digital trade. And when you put it, you know, in landscape, the way that the panels are laid out, it's almost like one long scroll. You could just keep going. I found it very fascinating. Obviously, that was, you know, Grell wasn't thinking, oh, in 30 years' time, there's going to be...
When people are reading it on their e-readers.
Yeah, exactly. But it's fascinating how the art translates into into digital format. It actually works really well.
Well, see, and I made the mistake of trying to read it in portrait, because I also read it on my tablet, and so I was reading it in portrait, and there were several pages at first where I'm like, this panel doesn't make sense going into this next panel.
Exactly.
And it wasn't telling me that it was page A and B, you know, so I couldn't, it took me, I had to read several pages before I realized that I was looking at a two-page spread. Because normally, on the reader, it'll kind of let you know.
Right. Well, that's the way this is drawn and laid out. It doesn't seem that way until you turn it into a landscape and you say, oh, wow. But the way that it just kind of scrolls, it's almost like a medieval tapestry that just keeps going on telling the story. Anyway, right. I found that very fascinating. But the art itself, this is what I'm going to get into. It has, it's very scratchy and almost sketch-like.
Yes.
And that is something that many artists of the time would take up, that kind of style.
Yes. You know,
that scratchy, almost amateur style. Liefeld.
Because it represents, because it represents like a darker tone. It represents a more muted morality, almost.
Yeah.
It's not clearly defined.
You know, I mean, unlike those later artists that would take up that scratchy style, Grell actually has respect for anatomy and tries to make people proportional, which is neat.
Right.
But it still has that, like a sketchbook, you know, especially there's some panels that are darker and... It's very good. I'm not trying to say anything against the art. The art is very good, but it's very unique and different.
But I think it's when he removes it's. I definitely get your point on that. And but I think it's when he does when he removes the human element and you get the scenery. And this goes back to the last book when they end up in the mountains and it's the snow and the huge trees and whatever. There are like. His landscape art in this is, I think it's quite gorgeous.
No, I agree. I agree 100%.
But it's less of that sort of scratchy that you're talking about too.
Right. It has, at that point, it's not really watercolor, but it has that sort of muted fade to the colors. Yeah.
But the light is brighter. When he goes there, the light is brighter too.
Mm-hmm.
Than in even daytime scenes in the previous two books, the light is even during daytime, it's a kind of a dark daytime.
Yeah. Whenever he cuts into a close-up, it's always really dark too.
Yeah.
Even if it's even in the same scene. So it's a daylight scene, and then suddenly there's a dark, dark panel, which, you know, it's interesting how it sets the page apart visually. I'm finding it really hard to describe it as far as, I can't find the right words for it. It's very unique. It's very different. It's something that, I don't know, I really see this as foreshadowing how artists will take this look and really run with it. And you'll
right. It led to Sins of Others.
It led to Sins of Others. That's brilliant. So this is kind of the thing I was kind of alluding to in the synopsis, where Grell was really, maybe not ahead of his time, but he was really tapping into something that was, you know, if you want a zeitgeist at the time or something.
Right.
And he was the first to really push this in a mainstream comic. And because of its popularity, because of its critical acclaim, so many would try to emulate this comic, sometimes very well, oftentimes not as well. And thus we get the 90s.
Hence the 90s.
Hence the 90s. And great things did come out of the 90s. Some great... you know, grimdark takes on things. This is one of those comics where I remember reading it at the time and was amazed by it, really blown away. This is something I had not seen before. Reading it now, after so many years, is so many people trying to emulate it and imitate it. I can't say that it holds up perfectly, but it is an important moment in comics.
It's worth reading, and it's there are very enjoyable parts. And like we said, it's particularly that last, that scene in the woods with the showdown between all of the antagonists and protagonists and, not the woods so much as the mountains, is quite stunning. And like you said, it really builds this great tension. Yeah. And it's, that is good comics work right there. Very good comics work.
Yeah. Good comics. Book three easily is my favorite of the whole series. But yeah, like I said, this is, I recommend people reading it. I don't think it holds up as well as some people think it does.
It may not be an essential on your shelf,
but it's important to see if you're interested in the history of comics and to see the evolution of comics, this was a milestone that would go on. I mean, there were some things beforehand, of course, that were getting into that darker tone. But this is the one I think that really pushed it, and the floodgates were open after this.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
All right. Well, are we done?
I think we're done.
All right.
I mean, we could go on for another hour, but...
But we're not going to. Brian!
Yes, Paul?
What's next on the collected edition?
Okay, so for my recommendation for our next fun and thrilling podcast, we are going to be reading one of my least favorite superhero characters.
Wow.
Indeed. We're going to be reading Iron Man, and we're going to be reading The Invincible Iron Man, issues 120 through 128, which compile the very famous Demon in a Bottle storyline.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Another dark
Grim dark. Actually, a good portion of it is not grim dark. You know, this is the 70s still, so. But yeah.
Yeah, this is exciting. I like the fact that you're choosing a character you don't really care for.
I know, right? It's important to broaden our horizons.
It is. It'll be in stark contrast to what we normally do.
Oh.
Thank you, everybody.
They'll be here all day.
Well, I look forward to that, actually, because that's actually a storyline I haven't read in a long time.
Yeah, I think it'll be good.
I think the only reason we do this is to go back and read things that we haven't read in a long time.
Read things that we've forgotten about. Yeah. Oh, yeah, there was that.
And then there was
another one. Let's talk about a podcast.
Well, I think that's it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Until next time, you can always get us online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes, or you can follow us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And if you do it on iTunes, please leave us a review, because that really does help us get found. You can always send us an email with your comments to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. And you can always hit us up on Twitter at CollectedEdPod. That's CollectedEdPod. And Brian's on Twitter, so he might actually reply to you.
That's, I'm twitting.
He's twitting. You've always been a twit to me, man.
Yay.
Okay. So thanks again for listening, everybody. Until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
That was weird. I have no idea what I'm going to get out of that. At all.
Well, I think you're right. Partly it's because we came up with it at the last minute, and neither of us had any time whatsoever to be like, oh, let me look up comic book marriages. And of course, neither of us actually, we were just like, hey, let's talk about marriages.
Yeah.
Without saying, hey, let's talk about marriages in context of...
Exactly. And then there was this time. It's the Chris...
Remember that time when...
Yeah, it's the Chris Farley episode of Collected Edition.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. Remember that marriage? Remember that marriage? Oh, good Lord.
You know, worst case scenario, you've got some outtakes for the next outtake show.
I think we got a lot of them.